We are joined here live in the studios once again by Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. So did you get your yodeling out of the way?
I did.
I'm not sure of that.
The things. Oh, great.
I've been watching the Ken Burns documentary on country music, and I'm just really listening to a lot of Jimmy Rogers right now, the yodeling brakeman.
Okay.
Let's not have a demonstration of that.
No, right. I won't.
Joff revealed he has a past that involved yodeling as well. Not sure we need to.
Let's not go into that.
We'll save that for
fun
drive.
Future extortion.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So starting out with, Seattle City Council and
yodeling
and hotel workers.
The Seattle City Council passed four bills this week to protect hotel workers, to get around the court challenges to I-124, which voters passed with an overwhelming majority of 77% back in 2016.
And which is not being enforced in a number of local hotels.
Yeah. Now, the court challenge to I-124 is related to it constituting multiple topics in one initiative, which is against state law. So the council took the provisions of I-124 and split it out into four separate bills. And they changed those bills somewhat. The bills that were passed at the city council would require employers to provide panic buttons to employees. It would force employers to add wages of between $420 to $1,260 per month to cover health care costs, particularly for health care insurance for their employees. And it would limit the number of square feet a worker may clean per day to 4,500 square feet. And if a worker cleans more than that, they get paid triple wages. Now, it also...
That's quite a bit, by the way.
That is quite a bit. It also prevents employers from setting unreasonable limits and forcing workers to work until they're literally exhausted every night or incur injuries, like back injuries, for example. It also includes new rules that would require companies to retain workers after a company changes ownership. The laws don't include some of the provisions that I-124 had. For example, the requirement that hotels maintain a list of guests accused of sexual misconduct for the purposes of denying those guests services in the future. That probably wouldn't have survived a legal challenge. On the other hand, the new laws do require hotels to have a sexual harassment policy in place, you know, like most modern workplaces do nowadays, and to investigate allegations of harassment and to remove an employee from contact with a guest who they've accused of harassing them. Now, hotels would also be required to inform their guests about the policy and the terms of the sexual harassment policy. Now, the new laws, of course, may still get challenged in court anyway, since there was a lot of pushback from hotels and, of course, and from some of the restaurants who are also housed within hotels in Seattle to these new laws, especially the requirement that they cover the costs of employee health insurance. But, you know, you have to say, look, if you guys don't support a single-payer national health plan, then businesses have to expect that healthcare costs for employees are going to be expensive. And when they don't provide insurance for their employees, Then they're pushing their employees onto the public to try to subsidize, which means health insurance costs for everybody else are going to go up. So in this case, I really don't have a whole lot of sympathy for these hotels and these restaurants who are saying, "Oh no, we have to provide health care coverage." Yeah.
Oh yeah. Horrors. I'm wondering with the court challenges currently in place to I-124, if the city council splitting that out into four different bills sort of buttresses the case of the court challenges that I-124 had multiple topics.
Yeah, it does. And in fact, the city council is going to vote to repeal I-124 to try to just end the court case altogether and to, of course, end the city's expenses in defending I-124.
All right. More on that?
Nope.
Okay. Also this week, turns out the Seattle City Pension Fund has been investing in some interesting businesses.
Yeah, the Seattle Globalist had this investigative piece, in which the pension fund for the city of Seattle has almost $750,000 in private prison stock for GEO Group, which operates the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, which, of course, has been the focus of a lot of activist concern over the past couple of years for its treatment of immigrant detainees. It also has over $50,000 in CoreCivic, which is the largest private prison company in the United States. So that's almost $800,000 in private prison stock. That should be a concern, particularly since the Seattle Pension Fund adapted in 2013 an ethical set of ethical guidelines which covered climate change but did not cover social justice issues. So that loophole is a concern. And also the board members of the pension fund have stated that they're not going to divest in stocks that don't meet their ethical guidelines. It's just a question of using those guidelines for new concerns. So I think there will be some pressure on the pension fund at this point to divest itself of some of those questionable investments. No doubt there are others. The Freedom of Information Act covered private prison stocks, but did not cover other pension investments that might be ethically questionable. And I'm sure there are others as well. And that would be the topic for future investigative journalists.
But that wasn't the only thing that that article covered. It turned out that they also had investments in fossil fuel, correct?
Yes, they had $71.5 million in fossil fuel company stock as of the middle of this year, despite the adoption of guidelines in 2013 that prioritize investments that positively impact climate change. One could reasonably say that those investments negatively impact climate change.
Oh, yes, one could definitely say that.
And one would be accurate in saying that.
And
as well.
One should say that as yes. much as possible.
Yes.
And seeing as the, you know, council has been wrestling with the Green New Deal, it seems a little bit
yes.
hypocritical.
And there were some people out in the streets yesterday talking about those very issues.
Did you want to jump to that?
Let's go go to
keep
Durkin's
going.
Plan
okay.
first.
Let's okay. start the plans. Okay, starting with her plan for prolific offenders.
Yeah, Mayor Durkin has been releasing pieces of her 2020 budget over the past 2 weeks in preparation for releasing the full budget plan next Monday, this coming Monday. This week, she rolled out the city and county's plan for how they would address, quote-unquote, prolific offenders, which they have renamed, which actually the mainstream media has renamed violent repeat offenders, and which the city has now renamed, let's see, what do they call them now, high barrier individuals. Yeah,
they're trying to find language that nobody knows what it actually means.
Yeah. Now, this is a problem supposedly identified by a very small and unscientific survey done back in February that sought to highlight the city's failure in prosecuting street crime. First of all, Durkin put together a task force. Durkin and Constantine put together a task force.
Of course.
Yeah. And
was it a blue ribbon task force?
Well, I don't know that it was a blue ribbon task force, but they looked at 500 repeat offenders. They found that these quote unquote high barrier individuals are primarily responsible not for violent crimes, but for a surge in property crimes, mostly in the downtown core. And of course, we already know that, right? The vast majority of those crimes are trespassing, shoplifting, and something called non-aggressive assault, which I'm not sure what that means, but my guess is that it's something like verbal assault and threats as opposed to actual physical
or aggressive panhandling that they can't prosecute under that name.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Now, the task force also found that 93% of these folks had records with the King County Behavioral Health and Recovery Division. Two-thirds had a clinical diagnosis within the last 3 years. 43% were diagnosed with schizophrenia, schizotypal, delusional, or other psychotic disorder. Three-quarters had suffered a behavioral or mental disorder because of psychoactive drug use, and half had had both a mental health condition and an addiction. So what were the task force's recommendations? Well, they mostly couldn't agree. That's what came out of this. And that's because the task force was made up of a combination of politicians, lawyers, judges, police, and health and human services providers. So a wide range of folks, but from the enforcement end as well as from the human services end. So there was a lot of disagreement between those two camps.
And I'm gonna guess that the mental health issues came before the addiction issues. People are trying to self-medicate.
Yeah, and it can be really hard to tell which is what's the chicken and what's the egg there. But there were four programs that the task force could agree on and that the mayor is willing to fund. First is a special enhanced shelter in the west wing of the King County Jail, which Durkin has called a quote-unquote treatment center. But the Downtown Emergency Services Center, who will be running that shelter, has said it will be a shelter first. And secondly, it will offer referrals to behavioral health and drug treatment programs. That does not make it a treatment center.
How can you have a shelter within a jail?
That's a good question. It's within the west wing of the jail. I believe it's on the second floor.
If it's the north wing, it wouldn't be that. Never mind.
Yeah. So that's a good question. That's all part of this now. In addition, it's only going to have 60 beds to hold at minimum 500 people. They were looking at 500 prolific offenders, and this shelter is supposed to address that. But as Job said, it's within the jail, so it looks like if you're using this shelter as a mandatory center where you're going to send these folks, it's looking like just another sort of soft version of jail, right? So another program that is part of this solution is a high barrier probation program. So that's tasking probation officers with getting their clients into treatment by offering them a reduction in their sentence if they complete drug and mental health treatment, and then tracking whether their clients actually stick with it. In other words, it's called high-intensity treatment or high-intensity supervision, a model that's really failed in other cities because, of course, it looks a whole lot like an extension of the criminal justice punishment system. Now, the third program is called Rapid Reentry Connector, provides connections to mental health, drug treatment, and other services for people who've been jailed for less than 72 hours. Currently, this is only provided for people who are held more than 3 days. And currently, there aren't enough openings in treatment programs to meet the existing demand, much less the higher demand that this is going to cause.
So they're willing to pour money into more hours for probation officers, et cetera, but they're not funding treatment programs.
No. And the fourth program, which you might expect would be money for treatment programs, right, to expand capacity where it's really needed.
One would hope.
No, it's a case conferencing program. It would allow multiple agencies to coordinate on an individual's case. For example, the city attorney's office, the Seattle Police Department, the Department of Corrections, and human services providers, et cetera.
Money for meetings. I feel better already.
Yeah. And of course, there are privacy hurdles here. And the big question is the question of trust. Human services providers, for example, don't really like their clients to perceive them as working with the Seattle Police Department because it lowers trust levels. And then people don't want to work with the human services providers. In fact, most of the human services providers and the public defenders in Seattle are questioning this whole approach. They see a much bigger need for more trained caseworkers on the street to build trust with people who have the most intractable drug addictions and very deep mental health issues. And the two are greatly intertwined for at least half of the folks that they're talking about, to try to get these folks to agree to come in off the street and to get some help, or at the very least to offer them help where they are now, with the idea that will lead to those folks committing fewer crimes and acting out less, which, of course, is what harm reduction really means, right? You meet people where they are, you build a relationship of trust with them, and then you try to give them the help that they want and are willing to accept.
Yeah, and currently it's almost impossible to build that trust because there aren't enough caseworkers, and they often rotate because people burn out on those jobs very quickly.
Yeah, and there aren't enough.
And they're paid very poorly.
And part of the reason they burn out is because, you know, what help can they provide when there's not enough not enough money to fund the treatment programs that are needed.
Yeah, and there's not enough openings to place people when they're ready.
Yeah, so really, if this all boils down, if Durkin's plan all boils down to just more harassment from probation officers, it's not going to do anything. And if anything, it's going to make the problems worse. and mandatory treatment, forcing people into a shelter in the jail has an abysmally high failure rate, as we've seen in other cities. People have to want to change before they'll actually do it. Focusing solely on sobriety instead of addiction management, for example, also leads to very high failure rates, especially for people who have been on the street and have been addicted for a very long time. But Durkin wants to throw about $3 million into these four programs, and the county is throwing in another $2.4 million, but I think it's going to be up to the city council to decide whether or not this is a good expense.
I could use $5 million. I could do better outcomes, too.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably could.
Wasn't one of the things they were going to do with this was rename probation officers to something that...
Probation counselors.
Yeah.
Yeah, which confuses the role of a probation officer. Probation officers generally are supposed to track whether their clients, a person who has been sentenced to treatment or to community service or something, is actually doing that, and if not, they haul them back to jail, right?
And they're not trained for the role of essentially case managers.
Yeah,
they're not trained for that at all. And
counselors are there supposedly to help a client regardless of what,
right?
Yeah, regardless of where they're at.
If I'm a client and I say, yeah, I started drinking again this week,
yeah,
a counselor would help you. But a probation officer would say,
you're
going
back
to jail.
Yeah, so that's confusing the role of probation officers. And it's really, I think, going to be detrimental.
So you're going back to jail, to a shelter, where we will force you into treatment.
Yeah, essentially. And the treatment is not going to be meeting your needs. It's going to be setting this criteria of you must always be sober all the time, 100%. You can never fail or else, we're sticking you in a cage again.
Well, there does seem to be some value in repurposing the jails. In this case, I'm assuming you're talking about the King County Jail?
Yeah.
Because they've already repurposed, 80 to 100 units there for sheltering the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're also currently having issues with the water there, that they seem to have some lead problems in the water.
Older building.
Bringing in bottles of it.
I think that's a good move to try to repurpose jail or to try to, divert people from going directly into a cage, where it's punishment and folks don't live on the street because they're healthy, normal, happy people. They live on the street because they've been subjected to trauma in their lives and they have medical conditions like schizophrenia, for example.
Or
a really difficult drug addiction to manage. Those folks need help. They don't need punishment.
And living on the street itself is extremely traumatizing.
Yeah, it's extremely traumatizing. And so the idea is you try to kind of see where people are, what the problems are, and to try to kind of slowly bring them out of that.
Yeah. So diverting people from jail would be a positive thing, but this is not what this is about.
This is not necessarily what this is about.
All right. So this obviously still is part of her budget proposal.
That's
basically what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, where Durkin is
kind of rolling out little,
different
little
programs.
And we'll have the full analysis next week when it comes out.
I think she's trying to build public support for pieces of her budget that she thinks are going to be controversial with the city council before they sit down and talk about it.
Oh, all right. Anything else on that particular proposal?
No. Nope.
All right. That wasn't the only thing her office came out with this week?
Yeah. She rolled out with another piece of her budget by announcing that she had found a source of cash to finance the Center City Connector streetcar and building more affordable housing. She wants the city to charge a 51-cent fee on all Uber and Lyft rides that originate or end in the city of Seattle. She estimates that in the next 6 years, that fee will raise $126 million, with about $56 million to go towards building the City Connector streetcar along First Avenue downtown. About $52 million would go for affordable housing near transit stops, and $18 million would fund a new dispute resolution center for Uber and Lyft drivers who've been done wrong by these two tech companies. And this raises a whole bunch of questions. My first question is, why not have a dispute resolution center for all workers in Seattle and not just Uber and Lyft drivers? Okay. My second question is, So really, you think $56 million is enough for the City Connector streetcar? Because the last I checked, it was $200 million to build the darn thing. And the feds are only offering $75 million if the city can come up with a solid source for the remaining funds, which has not happened yet.
And remind me, how much of that goes to affordable housing?
About $52 million.
$52 million. And it's about $300,000 per unit to build affordable housing.
I know.
So you're going to get 180 units out of this. That ought to be helpful
the
for
thinks, the city thinks that'll pay for 500 units, but I don't think so.
For the 10,000 or so people who are on the street now.
Now.
Let alone all the other people that need affordable housing.
Right. And there's another question here, too, really. Uber and Lyft are not profitable companies. Lyft is expecting to lose $875 million this year alone, and I think that's an underestimate. And Uber, which is the bigger company, far bigger company, lost over $5.2 billion in the last quarter. Yes, just the last 3 months that they were tracking, they lost $5.2 billion. And so you have to ask the question, are these companies really going to stay in business for that much longer? You know, in other words, is this a fee that is going to be a stable source of revenue for the city that they can count on to get those federal funds for the City Connector streetcar? And I think the answer to that is no.
I think Uber and Lyft are positioning themselves to be bought out by somebody.
They took their companies public. Uber took its company public,
right,
which is why we now know how much money they're losing, is because this is the second quarter that they've reported financials to the public, and if they're losing that much money, they're not a going concern in my mind.
No, nor are they attracting a lot of new investors.
No. In addition, some parts of Durkin's plan could be challenged in court. For example, her mandate that Uber and Lyft pay their drivers a minimum wage of $16 per hour might not stand up to legal scrutiny because their drivers are not hourly employees. They're actually piece workers. Essentially,
And they're not full-time either.
No, they're not full-time. Essentially, they only get paid for the miles when they have a passenger in the car, and the companies will certainly sue to overturn this part of Durkin's plan. I think there's no question to that. And finally, there's the question of fairness. Now, this fee, if Uber and Lyft remain in business, will provide much less revenue than the employee hours tax, or the head tax, would have provided for things like affordable housing. Instead of taxing business activity in Seattle, the mayor is instead choosing to tax one transportation option for individual city residents. And it's an option that many middle and lower class income residents now rely on, especially if they don't have a car in the city of Seattle. So there's that question of fairness here. Instead of taxing overall business activity by the largest corporations in the city of Seattle, which is what the head tax would have done, you're actually turning around trying to tax two companies that are not profitable. And the work done by people who are trying to supplement their regular steady jobs with the occasional, you know, trip in their car, and the transportation choices of people who maybe can't afford a cab or who don't have great bus service or who have an emergency need to get from one place to another but don't have a car. So I think there's some issue of fairness there too.
Yeah, and ethics. I mean, I know a couple mm-hmm. people that have been Uber and Lyft drivers and or still are, and they are not faring well at all.
Mm-hmm. No, I know people in the same boat.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's, I mean, she might as well propose, let's create a program for letting Uber Lyft drivers sleep in their cars.
Yeah, it also institutionalizes what I think is a bad business model, this whole idea of we're going to take advantage of these drivers and treat them like sweatshop workers. Essentially,
the gig economy.
Yeah, and so when the city says, "Well, wow, let's collect our piece off of that too," it institutionalizes a really bad business model.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, back to.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Seattle Times had a couple of articles in the last couple of days. They had done a document request from the city of Seattle, a FOIA request for some information on conversations between the mayor's attorney and an attorney that represents the Community Police Commission over when the Community Police Commission reviewed Mayor Durkin's plan for dealing with the police accountability issues, particularly police discipline at the Seattle, under the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract.
And trying to meet the demands set by Judge Robart.
Yeah, the Community Police Commission reviewed her plan and said that they did not like it, and they voted unanimously to reject the plan. Instead of giving the mayor's office a heads up ahead of time to give her the opportunity to try to talk the CPC out of their decision, the Community Police Commission released that report directly to the media and the mayor's office at the same time. Well, this caused some consternation in Mayor Durkin's office. And
even though she hasn't done any outreach to the CPC.
Yeah, and the judge tasked her with doing that. So what she did is, instead of talking to the CPC, she went around the commission as a whole, and she and other members of her office decided to buttonhole individual commission members and try to get information from them on how the decision was made to reject her report. Now, the lawyer for the
community, they read it.
Yeah, the lawyer for the Community Police Commission says that, you know, that's intimidation. She's trying to intimidate individual members of the Community Police Commission and get them to change their mind and speak out and so forth. And so there's a little bit of a scandal going on there. Now, City Attorney Pete Holmes, who is tasked with defending Durkin's office, says that he hasn't seen any evidence that the mayor is trying to strong arm any members of the Community Police Commission. However, the lawyer for the Community Police Commission, David Perez, says that he has emails from the mayor's office showing that she did indeed do some direct contact with individual members, and that's improper. So he's satisfied now, though, that after sitting down with members of the mayor's office and the city attorney Pete Holmes, that they're not going to do that in the future. That she's not going to try to pull aside individual members of the Community Police Commission and get them to cause trouble on the commission.
Perhaps she could put together a plan that wouldn't be a non-starter. That might help, too.
That would help, yeah. And, in fact, there was a little bit of discussion about that this week in a city council hearing, a public hearing, on the upcoming talks with the union that represents upper management within the Seattle Police Department. They held a hearing. The city council held a hearing on Wednesday. And a longtime attorney for the ACLU of Washington, Jeffrey Robinson, who is actually also a friend of Mayor Durkin and supported her run for mayor, he spoke at that hearing, and he came out against the idea of the city of Seattle comparing their disciplinary process within the Seattle Police Department against 20 other cities around the nation. Now, which
is Durkin's plan.
Yeah, which is essentially Durkin's plan. And Robinson's remarks, I just want to read them aloud, some pertinent outtake of his remarks, said, quote, "We shouldn't be looking at other cities to see what they have done because, quite frankly, there are no other cities in America that are doing this right. The eyes of America are going to be on Seattle because Seattle is seen as a leader in this area, and I'm asking you to please understand that. Don't look at what other cities do. Look at what should be done here," end quote. So that's what he said in the city council hearing. And what happened after that hearing is that Mayor Durkin's office called him up.
Is it he mysteriously disappeared?
No, he got a call from Mayor Durkin's office. And after that phone call, he came out and told the Seattle Times, "Oh, no, I wasn't testifying about her plan at all. In fact, I hadn't even read her plan, so I didn't know anything about it when I testified before the city council." Now, if that's true, then his remarks are even more valuable in my mind, because he's not playing politics when he made those remarks. He was literally speaking the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, if what he's saying now is true, that he didn't know the specifics of Durkin's plan. Now, folks at that time thought he was talking about her plan, but if he wasn't talking about her plan, then his remarks are even more valuable, because yeah, they're made coming from an atmosphere of, I don't know what's going on in your city, but this is what I understand from looking at police reform and police discipline and police accountability issues all across the United States is that there isn't a good example for you to look at anywhere else. You're really the leader on this. And the city council should take that to heart.
But it was interesting, the back and forth that happened after that.
Oh, it was very interesting, yeah.
Seattle Times, from my reading of it, Seattle Times contacted Durkin's office for comment. They said, oh, we don't see the connection with what you're asking
us. Yeah, what? Why are you calling us?
And then Durkin's office contacts them.
Contacts Robinson directly. And then he recounts.
They're talking to the ACLU back and forth.
Yeah, he recounts and says, I wasn't talking about her plan.
So,
yeah.
And he also, I guess.
That's Durkin's office.
From listening to the audio of his testimony, also apparently used to work with Lorena Gonzalez. I mean, when she introduced him, it became clear that he has worked with a lot of people.
With a lot of people in Seattle, yeah.
Which makes it that much less credible that he wasn't aware of
Durkin's plan, yeah. I'm pretty sure he was.
But. We'll see. We'll find out more in the future. All right. Moving on, it was really hard to get around anywhere yesterday. And if you're in a vehicle,
that's what happens when you have feeder marchers. A remarkable turnout yesterday for the global climate strike, both in Seattle and around the country and around the world. Some 150 different countries, countless cities and towns around the world, and the estimate that I saw was 4 million people turning out globally, which is certainly a record for an environmental protest, but probably a record, period.
150 cities?
150 countries.
150 countries, yeah. So yeah. Multiple cities in some countries.
There were dozens of cities in a lot of countries. And, hundreds of thousands of people in New York, hundreds of thousands of people in places like Brisbane, Australia, where the coral reefs are melting, turnouts Kiribati and Solomon Islands, and some
which
of the
are drowning
low-lying island countries, and a lot of places in Africa, a lot of places in Europe, of course, and here in the United States and North America. It was really a remarkable turnout, and if you get hundreds of thousands of people in New York and thousands of people in Seattle, the difference there is that in New York, the city and the school district there excused people and said this is a valuable thing for students to do. Here in Seattle, the Seattle Public Schools said, nope, if you're missing, we'll mark you as unexcused. Invaluable words of David Lee Roth, this will go on your permanent record. and I'm sure that dissuaded some people from turning out yesterday, which is really unfortunate because as the headline today in the Seattle Times said, this is more important than school. And it really is. And it's a really valuable experience for a lot of students to go through that this is what civic engagement looks like. And this is how valuable it can be. And that it's fun, honestly. And that it's effective. And that's a valuable lesson for any students to learn. And it's unfortunate that Seattle Public Schools didn't see it that way.
Yeah, I saw something on online, which of course makes it true, that Seattle Public Schools actually has a rule that students, if they have a signed note from their parents, they can miss school 2 days per year for religious reasons or for reasons of conscience. So
well, there you go.
So actually, if that had been known, I think a lot of kids, if they just had their parents sign it up.
Yeah, and that was the setup in New York where if they had a note from their parents, they were fine. And that was not the case in Seattle, but it would be under that rule because, my religion is that I would like to have a little planet when I'm age.
There should be a group of parents who hit back at the Seattle School District on this and say, okay, look, my kid was absent because.
And there are school board elections coming up in November.
And I don't know if, every school does it, but the school I went to, which was, fairly well-funded, they had things where you go on field trips.
Sure, I remember field trips.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. So I'm not the only one.
I think if I'd been a teacher, that would have been in my mind. Hey, let's take a field trip, guys.
See how democracy works.
Good news is we're not going to a museum this time.
Yeah.
You're going to get some exercise.
Going to the Seattle Center for the umpteenth time.
Yep.
All right. So
so it was really incredibly inspiring, both the turnout at Cal Anderson and the march to City Hall yesterday, and the seeing pictures and videos of places all over the world where people were doing similar things. The kids are all right.
Lots of remarkable great jobs.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to national and completely unconnected to what we just were talking about, Houston, Texas.
Yeah, Houston, Texas didn't have a march yesterday. They sent people to a march in the state capitol in Austin, where students from all over Texas converged. But the reason students in Houston couldn't mobilize is that Houston was underwater for the fourth 500-year flood in the last 5 years. And having lived in Houston in the past, I can say that Houston is particularly prone to these kinds of floods. It's built on a marsh. It is, the way the freeways are designed, there's a lot of underpasses that flood easily. There's a lot of bayous that go over their banks easily. And particularly in poorer neighborhoods, they're vulnerable to this. And we've seen this. We saw this with Hurricane Harvey, which stalled over Houston and dumped 60 inches of rain.
It wasn't just Houston, though. It was other areas of southeast Texas.
Yes, it was.
Well.
What happened is Tropical Storm and briefly Hurricane Imelda changed course and unexpectedly moved west. When Houston thought it was in the clear, suddenly it wasn't. And again, it was a slow moving storm and dumped 4 to 6 inches of rain per hour on parts of southeast Texas.
Just like other storms we've seen, it's not the wind speed. It's the amount of water that they carry now.
Yeah, and the amount of water is caused by unusually warm waters, in this case in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And this is directly related to climate change. No one storm can be attributed to climate change, but when you get four of these in 5 years, there's a trend there.
Yeah.
And it's a very clear trend, and it's a very obvious trend as to what's causing it. And this, again, is impetus as all the other extreme weather events this year, the hottest year in recorded history. These are the times we live in, and the students are right. We need action right now. We don't need more blue ribbon commissions, and we don't need major political parties denying that climate change exists, and presidents that deny that climate change exists, and presidents doing everything possible to exacerbate climate change by stripping away environmental regulations, which we saw again this week with Trump trying to prevent California's stricter auto emission standards.
Mm-hmm. And trying to change the clean water regulations.
Yes. We've seen this over and over again with the Trump administration, where they seem to be thrilled with the notion of dirty air and dirty water if it will make a tiny bit more profit for extremely profitable energy companies over the short term. Of course, the energy companies themselves understand climate change and are trying to move into renewable energies get money from that. But these are often deregulatory moves that the energy companies themselves don't want, because they're trying to present a public face that they care about renewable energy, and they don't want necessarily these deregulatory actions at this time, but they're getting them anyway.
Doesn't Houston, I know it does, have a massive oil infrastructure, and once it floods, doesn't that pretty much start distributing that oil all across that area?
Most of the petrochemical facilities, and there are a lot of them, I used to work in them actually, are along the Houston Ship Canal, which is essentially a canal that connects with Galveston Bay so that it can... It's Houston itself is one of the largest ports in the country.
So it backs up, right?
It floods.
When there's a storm surge.
When there's a storm surge or flooding, the ship canal will flood. And, the petrochemical facilities themselves are vulnerable to flooding. As you might expect, adjacent to those that area.
The lower income neighborhoods
tend to be
near there.
Tend to be lower income neighborhoods, particularly African American and Latino neighborhoods. And it's not surprising that those are the ones that flood first.
Okay, moving on. You talked about last week how the Trump administration was nuking medical help for certain migrants.
Yeah, it's called a medical deferment program. And under that, for a number of years, the United States has allowed extremely ill kids with rare diseases to come into the United States for treatment where they can't get treatment in their home countries. And where, because by definition they're rare diseases, it increases the sample size where doctors and researchers can study ways to treat these diseases. So it's valuable for those researchers as well. And in August, the Trump administration, without publicly announcing it, sent letters to the families of these kids saying, "You have 33 days to leave the country. We're canceling this program." This was first reported in Boston, and then came up in local media in Miami and the Bay Area as well, and eventually worked its way up to national media and to Congress, which held a hearing on this last week, which we talked about, in which the Republicans are saying, "Oh, these kids aren't really sick, and the Trump administration would never really use this." Of course, the reason that didn't work very well is some of those sick kids were there to testify under oath, and they very clearly were sick. And they very clearly were facing death if they were deported back to their home countries because they can't get treatment for those conditions in their home countries. Well, there was another hearing scheduled for this week at which the Homeland Security acting director was subpoenaed to testify. Didn't really want to, but he was subpoenaed to. And suddenly, the night before that hearing was to be held, the Trump administration, again without publicly announcing it, sent a letter to Congress saying, "Well, we've decided to cancel this program, so the director won't be appearing because he doesn't need to appear now." Of course, there's still a lot of questions like who ordered this.
You mean canceling the deportation of these kids?
Canceling the cancellation of the medical deferment program. And so the kids who were basically facing a death sentence will be allowed to live. That's mighty generous of the Trump administration. And there's still a lot of questions, like who originally ordered this plan, which is really the premeditated.
Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the name.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah, sure.
We know the names.
Yeah.
Right?
And
within the Trump administration.
This is basically premeditated murder of these kids. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of these kids around the country in medical facilities, you know, leading medical facilities like Seattle Children's Hospital, like Boston Children's Hospital, hospitals in the Bay Area, Miami, some of these other cities. And the kids can stay for the time being, assuming that the Trump administration actually does cancel this order, which is, you know, no guarantee. We've certainly seen, as with the separation policy, where the Trump administration will very noisily say, "No, we're not doing this anymore," and then they go ahead and continue to do it. So we'll have to continue to watch this. But for the time being, that's very good news for these families and good news for people who are concerned about the sheer cruelty of Trump administration immigration policies.
All right. Also this week, there was some kerfluffle, is that the word you used to, about potential whistleblower talking about Trump communications?
Yeah, this has been leaking out steadily over the course of this week, and it's something that has official Washington in a tither, as we might say. A whistleblower in the intelligence community came forward to the Intelligence Community Inspector General with a complaint. We still don't know the nature of that complaint, although we've had some media reports concerning it. So the Inspector General found that, legally speaking, and the legal language here is important because it's the threshold for Congress to act, that this was credible and it was of urgent concern. And it involved President Trump, and it involved a phone call that President Trump's had with world leaders. Now, there were only a certain number of world leaders that Trump talked with on the phone, in the relevant timeline here, Two of them were the newly elected president of Ukraine and Vladimir Putin of Russia. And the subsequent media reports apparently have Trump asking the leader of Ukraine, who was newly elected and very pro-Western, eight times in the course of a single conversation to instigate an investigation of Joe Biden's son. Now, this is a serious problem because you're talking about, and we talked about that son that this show the last couple of weeks, that the Trump administration had been withholding legally mandated military aid to Ukraine to the tune of $250 million. That military aid was released a couple of weeks ago, but it was being withheld during the course of this summer. And there's a question of quid pro quo.
Yeah, and it was only released after Adam Schiff, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, asked the White House for information on the whistleblower's complaint. Then, the very next day, the Trump administration released the aid.
Yes, and there was also a hearing scheduled in Congress on that aid for the week that it was released. So yeah, there was some pressure that was applied, and the Trump administration...
Yeah, and apparently,
suddenly caved.
Apparently, Donald Trump, in those conversations with the new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he pressured Zelensky to meet with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to discuss reopening investigations of the company that Hunter Biden worked for, a natural gas company that was operating in Ukraine, even though that company had been investigated before and the investigation closed with no evidence of any wrongdoing or corruption.
Exactly. And there are plenty of companies under the previous regime that were corrupt. So it was not a high priority for the Ukrainians.
But, you know, it leads to the question, too, of why would Trump send his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to talk about these things with the president of the Ukraine, and not send a trained diplomat.
Yeah.
Well, the answer to that, I think, is he knows that he's asking for something that's not legal.
Yeah, even though that meeting was the meeting did actually happen with an aide to Zelensky and Rudy Giuliani. They met in Paris this past month, and at that meeting, again, Giuliani was pressing for an investigation of Hunter Biden and the company that he worked for. Now, the problem with this, of course, is when you're talking about a quid pro quo, you know, Trump is offering or withholding United States government policy in exchange for personal benefit, something that he's hoping to use against Joe Biden if Biden is the Democratic nominee for president next year. So he's trying to... basically using U.S. government assets for his own personal gain and using a foreign government to do that also, which is also illegal. So this is something that is
an impeachable offense
on a number of counts, not the least of which being that, you know, Trump was arguably elected in the first place with the assistance of a foreign government
from Russia.
And remember also in this time frame, he also the original whistleblower complaint talked about multiple incidents, and Trump also talked with Putin, and we don't know yet the content of that conversation, but you can imagine it being something like, sure, you can do whatever you want with Ukraine in exchange, can you hack these particular state voter registration databases for me, or some other kind of targeted hacking. You can imagine Trump doing this because he's completely immoral, number one, and because number two, he has a track record, and he actually said in June in an interview with George Stephanopoulos, sure, I'd take assistance from a foreign government again. Why wouldn't I do that, aside from the fact that it's illegal?
Yeah, and treasonous.
And treasonous, yeah.
And an impeachable offense.
Yeah, and particularly treasonous because you're talking about hostile foreign governments as well. A government that attacked the U.S. election system in 2016 and is doing so again in the run-up to 2020. That's already happened.
Yeah, and I think there's a key point here, too. I think Trump is thinking, you know, he is president, therefore he equals the United States government, you know. And
yeah, he makes no distinction.
That he personally receives, that he personally benefits from, is therefore a benefit to the United States government. That is not the case. And that is a real problem.
Yeah, l'état c'est moi. Yeah, which was Louis the 14th,
I believe. That's a dictator's attitude.
Absolutely it is. It is. Yeah. That's the point. Or a king's.
Yeah, and that's the reason, I think, why the House needs to kind of get on the stick and really push forward with these impeachment hearings and not just have this, the Democrats in the House have this sort of yes, we're doing it, no, we're not, yes, we're doing it, no, we're not thing going
well,
on.
Well, they're doing it, but they're doing it very slowly and methodically. Mm-hmm. And that's fine for a situation in which new impeachable offenses are not occurring every week.
But, you know, that's the thing with Trump. He's a liar and he cheats, and that's what he does, and he does it habitually. It's not a one-time thing.
And every time he gets away with something outrageous, he's pushing the bar for doing more outrageous things
next
time.
Exactly.
And we're seeing this happen, and what we're seeing is that he will do anything to try to get reelected, including cheating, including possibly manipulating the vote totals. And it's a real concern because the Democrats are proceeding as though this is normal operating procedure. And we're not in normal time.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary time, and it needs extraordinary measures.
Absolutely, and we're not seeing that yet from the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what we did see this week was at least two different major drone strikes.
Yeah, I want to talk about two separate drone strikes, but they're kind of related. One happened in Saudi Arabia and one happened in Afghanistan. Now, the drone strike that disabled about half of Saudi Arabia's oil processing capacity this week got a lot of coverage in the U.S. press, particularly with Donald Trump beating his chest against Iran and then eventually walking
it
back.
With no evidence.
Yeah. Now, and that could be the reason why he walked it back, could partly be because the satellite photos don't really support an attack from the north or northwest, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo originally asserted.
Yeah, and John Bolton before he was unceremoniously dumped.
Oh, yeah, the damage at the facilities actually seemed to be on the western side of the complexes, which would be consistent with a drone attack from Yemen. Nor is it clear why the U.S. would get involved in a war that Saudi Arabia started with the neighboring nation of Yemen, except, you know, the price of oil. And there were millions of people in the streets.
And the United States has been giving a lot of military aid to Saudi Arabia for that war.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the U.S. might be concerned about the price of oil because, yes, the price of oil is going up because of the attacks against Saudi Arabia. But, you know, like I said, there were millions of people in the street this week who were asking the United States and other nations, why are we still relying on oil when we got to shift away from it? Now, there was a second drone strike, and this time that drone strike happened in Afghanistan this week. It was a U.S. drone that killed at least 30 people and wounded 28 when it bombed a group of people who were harvesting pine nuts in Nangarhar province. Now, it is September, and September is harvest month in all agricultural communities around the world, at least
in the Northern Hemisphere. Exactly.
Yeah. So why the United States would be sending drones to bomb people who are harvesting, that's a really good question.
Because they couldn't find any wedding parties.
I guess. And yes, there was also a Taliban attack on the same day as the U.S. drone strike. The Taliban used a truck bomb to target a hospital in Zabul province, one of the few areas that's not already under Taliban control. They killed 22 people compared to the U.S.'s 28. So, of course, you can see here the efficiency of drone strikes and why we shouldn't be surprised now that the Houthi faction in Yemen is using drones against Saudi Arabia in revenge for the past 5 years of Saudi jets just bombing the crap out of Yemen.
Yeah, and creating one of the biggest humanitarian crises.
Probably
in the world.
The biggest humanitarian crisis currently in the world, with millions of people on the brink of starvation. So let's put this in perspective. I mean, we hear the U.S., we see the U.S. media make a big deal out of Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo saying it's Iran's fault. It's Iran's fault. They're dangerous. They're dangerous. Well, yeah, Saudi Arabia is not doing anything dangerous right now by bombing the heck out of their neighbor to the southwest. And they've been doing it for 5 years. And the United States is providing massive amounts of military assistance to Saudi Arabia to continue that aerial bombing campaign. I think even the Saudis couldn't muster up any courage to point the finger at Iran for that reason, because it really is just part of the war between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, which up till now has been very one-sided.
And the fact that Trump sort of quietly walked that back, I'm sure the Crown Prince had a conversation with his good buddy Jared Kushner.
That was very much part of it.
And they got on the same page after that.
And I see reports today that, the Trump administration is sending some troops purely as defensive measure to Saudi Arabia, to that area.
So. Hundreds, not thousands, was the quote.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We'll see.
All right. So events. We have a lot of events.
Yeah, and I want to talk first of all about one that already started but is still going on down in Pioneer Square, the We the People rally in March. The rally should still be going on or stepping off on the march soon. It's at Pioneer Square Park, if you happen to be down that area, at the Pergola at First and Yesler. So go join those folks if you still can, if you were nearby. Check that out.
Okay, and then today, or on Monday, the 23rd, is a meeting of the Housing, Health, Energy, and Workers' Rights Committee of the Seattle City Council, where Council Member Shama Sawant will introduce her draft legislation for rent control for Seattle. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. at City Hall at 5th and James downtown.
Yes, universal rent control, and the quote from Sawant's office is, no corporate loopholes.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes.
On Tuesday, author Naomi Klein, in conversation with City Council Member Teresa Mosqueda on her new book, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. That's going to be at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. On Wednesday is Pack the Room, the EPA's public hearing on rolling back water quality rules in Washington State. That's a public hearing, so come and tell them what you think about that. That's at 2 p.m. at the Region 10 offices of the EPA at 1200 6th Avenue, Suite 900 in downtown Seattle.
Yeah, and that needs a big turnout.
Yeah. On Thursday, City Council candidate debates for District 3 and District 7. District 3 debate starts at 5:30 p.m. and District 7 debate starts at 7:30 p.m. Those are both at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. And then next Saturday, City Council candidate debate for District 1, hosted by the District 1 Community Network from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. at Neighborhood House at 6400 Sylvan Way Southwest. There will be interpreters there for Vietnamese and Somali attendees. And then next Sunday is the counter-protest against racism, Just Say No to Racism, to counter a rally of racist hate groups planned for Westlake Park downtown at 3 p.m., This is hosted by Black Lives Matter Seattle Original Group. And also next Sunday is the People's Town Hall on Nuclear Weapons. That's hosted by the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Yeah, that'll be a big one.
Yeah, at 2 p.m. at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. That's a week from this Sunday.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about those city council races in the coming weeks as we get closer to
the election. As we get closer to the election, there's going to be a whole lot more advertising for the Seattle Chamber of Commerce picks in each of those races.
Yes.
So we will be talking quite a bit more about those as we get closer to the election.
Yep.
Yep. Their flyers are at the printer as we speak.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
All right.
They're cutting the TV out.
Oh, and can I just say, if you like to listen to this show and you enjoy the programming that is provided by KODX, we're an all-volunteer station and we rely solely on donations. So please visit our website at kodxseattle.org, and there's a Patreon button at the top of the page. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, there is also a PayPal button for one-time donations. Or if you would like to send us a check, the address is P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145. Please make out the check to Earth on the Air Independent Media.
And thank you to people who have already donated, and if you can always donate again. But people who have been listening to this program, if you find the information valuable, we really, really need your help to keep the station running. And if you're interested in volunteering, also let us know. We can always use more volunteers for the
Yeah,
station.
And don't forget that we have programming all week long except for Sundays. So there's some great programming on the weekdays as well as on Saturdays.
And we're very close Check to expanding out. Our programming to 24/7.
We are.
I know I've been teasing that one for a while. And that carrot's looking pretty mangy, but it's going to happen.
We are getting closer.
By the end of the month.
Yeah, but, but we can use your help in order to make that happen, too.
Definitely.
So please send us some money.
And everybody who's contributed so far has actually gotten us to where we are right now.
So thank you all.
Yep.
All right. So we'll plan on seeing you both.
Next week.
Hearing you both next week.
Yes.